WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello, and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio. I am Jason Mann, and joining me today, he is my colleague at FairToFlare.com. He is the man behind the esteemed wrestling blog and also the highly regarded wrestling podcast, Tom Holzerman. TH, how are you doing today?
Not only that, but I also would not kiss another man's crush, and I would not let him be thrown off the stage in his wheelchair.
You would not do that?
No.
Okay, you are better than John Cena then.
A lot of people are better than John Cena.
I guess.
Broskies before Hoskies.
Is that the way it goes?
It's the way it goes.
Okay, well, I'm glad to know this. I don't always know these things, so I'm glad to know. So we are traveling back in time to 1998, and we're going to talk about the main event of Halloween Havoc 1998.
The main event seen not by the hundred thousands of people on pay-per-view, but seen by the millions of people on Monday Nitro because of a snafu in production.
Right. Well, that snafu only affected actually a small amount of the audience. Most people actually saw it that night. It was only, it was like a tenth maybe of the audience, which is not an insignificant number, but I think that's sort of overblown as, I mean, it was certainly an embarrassing, silly thing that they... You know, basically what happened was they stretched the pay-per-view out to 3 hours and 30 minutes, and not all the cable companies got the message in time, so some of them cut off, I guess, a few minutes into this match.
And to their credit, they didn't make good for all the people that make good actually, you know, exposed a lot of people to a pretty good wrestling match.
This is a pretty fantastic wrestling match, actually. I would have to say this is I remember liking this match a lot at the time, but just having watched it recently, I think it really holds up, and I think it's even better than I remember. Just really energetic yet well paced. Just a lot of good things going on.
Yeah, and it really surprised me. I had watched this match for the first time on YouTube a couple of weeks ago. Because for my own blog, for the wrestling blog, I'm setting out to try and find out something, whether Goldberg was underrated historically. I mean, I'd always remembered him as being this guy who squashed people, and when he had to go in longer matches, he wasn't really that good. But I've heard a number of people, starting with my friend Dylan, who swears Goldberg was a really good wrestler, to you yourself during the Starcade series when you're talking about how Goldberg, when it came time, he could do a good longer match. And this kind of, like, fascinates. I want to know, did we give Goldberg the credit that was really due to him, or were we short-shrifting him because of some things that, you know, maybe were his fault, but they were accidents? I mean, yeah, he ended Bret Hart's career, but at the same time, shit happens in wrestling. Right.
Oh yeah, I mean, right. I mean, obviously, hitting Bret Hart so hard in the head with a super kick that he ended his career is certainly an awful thing, and I'm sure he was, I'm sure he felt very bad. But yeah, accidents happen in the ring. I mean, a lot of, you know, unfortunate things happen, as we often see, and you know, maybe that should be held against him in the safety department. But as far as having, as far as I know, nothing like that ever happened, you know, otherwise. It's not like he was a guy, you know, maybe he was a stiff guy to work with, but he wasn't a guy who routinely went around hurting people like, you know, Ahmed Johnson, for instance, or somebody like that, you know.
And I think looking at, like, sort of safety, I mean, some of the greatest wrestlers of all time had injuries that were at their hands. Steve Austin injured Ricky Steamboat, and Ricky Steamboat never wrestled a match after that. And in turn, Owen Hart injured Steve Austin. By all accounts, D'Lo Brown is in a terrible worker, a terrible wrestler, or a unsafe guy, but he was the guy who ended Draz's career. And, you know, just stuff happens.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. So basically, the deal with this pay-per-view is an interesting show because this really was like a big, lots of feuds were ending or basically ending in this pay-per-view. It was a buildup of a lot of big feuds, and this really wasn't even necessarily the biggest match on the show, but it got the final placement. And that was a very good decision because the big feud here was Hogan versus Warrior, which would be a big return, you know, 8 years after their famous WrestleMania match in 1990, and really pretty much a huge disaster all around as far as how it was presented, how the Warrior acted. Just, you know, the fans completely rejected the Warrior. The match was pretty awful, but it was still kind of a big deal that they hadn't wrestled in 8 years, and it was a long, you know, they spent a couple months building it up. So it was at least anticipated, even if not for the right reasons. There was a long-standing Hall versus Nash match that had been built up for the year. There was Sting versus Bret Hart, who had, you know, both kind of been the guys for their respective companies in the 90s, and then finally building up in the battle of, you know, having the same submission holds. Also, the first battle really between the Steiners, you know, of course, longtime tag team, they had broken up and they had teased forever they were going to finally, you know, Rick was finally going to get his hands on Scott. It finally happened here. So a lot of big matches being built. There's also a really awesome Jericho Raven match out of nowhere at the beginning of the show. So Halloween Havoc 98, if you know, for the people who have not checked it out, definitely one of the better WCW pay-per-views, particularly of 98, 99, you know, in 2000.
Yeah, I didn't see the whole one. I have to admit, I wasn't as big a WCW guy in those days as I was a WWF guy. And when I lived at home, I guess I can say it now because it's all really water under the bridge, my mom got us cable through nefarious means, so we actually got to see all the pay-per-views for free. And I by choice, I would watch WWF and sometimes when I got the chance, ECW. So I chose really not to watch WCW, and I kind of regret that looking back at it because, I mean, there was a lot of good stuff going on and it really wasn't going up against anything. What did I have really to, choose, you know, maybe during football season, but at the same time, I was still a bigger wrestling fan than I was a football fan.
Sure. Now, was that you identified with WWE and ECW and you just kind of were like, was it like a brand loyalty thing or was it more just you just weren't interested because of what they were doing?
A little bit of everything, mainly because I was a snot-nosed little kid, you know, and like I was a teenager. Teenagers are stupid.
They are sometimes.
Teenagers are really, really dumb. Mm. And they're really, I was a particularly sort of dumb teenager, so
fair enough. Nobody's perfect. So we have one thing that I thought was interesting is that Michael Buffer. I always like to know what Michael Buffer does or wears or what have you, because I'm always fascinated by the differences. Michael Buffer, wearing pretty much his normal tuxedo here, he announces the doctors who are in attendance. I forgot to write down their names. And referee Mickey J. Like, he makes a point to mention, okay, these guys, the doctors in attendance, which I don't recall him regularly doing. So I don't know.
He must have paid a little bit extra for that. I mean,
I would imagine, you know, I would imagine that maybe the doctors paid him a little bit just to give some, you know, like a little bit of advertising there, you know?
Yeah, you would think so.
Very possible.
I know Buffer. It's a very interesting, very popular topic on Retrospective Radio.
Sure.
The how much Buffer cost, and I just kind of think that they sort of had him on retainer at this point.
Well, they had him every month, so yeah, I'm sure he was getting. You know, he was. I would guess he was getting high four figures, low five figures every appearance. That would be my guess, but
yeah.
You know, that's just logic. I really have no basis for that, but
and I guess they paid Buffer a little bit extra here just as sort of like a make good to Goldberg and DDP because you know they put him on last and make him feel a little bit special. Hey, you're the champion. We're not really treating you like you're the champion. So
right. Well,
and we've got all these other matches, especially the Hulk Hogan Warrior stuff, a match that shouldn't have happened again after WrestleMania 6.
Yeah. Well, I don't have any problem with it happening again. It was just the fact that Warrior was washed up. Hogan, you know, wasn't able to carry somebody like Warrior into that. I mean, the whole story was terrible. I mean, the fact that they were fighting again, I didn't have a problem with that necessarily. I was actually excited about it at first because I didn't know any better that Warrior was, you know, I mean, I knew he was bad or regarded as bad, but I was still kind of excited because I missed his 96 run, so I hadn't seen him in 6 years. So, you know, I was excited about that, but obviously knowing now how ridiculous that was, but at the time, you know, it's like, ooh, what, Warrior's back, yay, you know, kind of thing. So,
yeah, I by that point I was sort of jaded by the Warrior. So,
right.
I was actually kind of done with the Warrior around his first comeback at WrestleMania 8. I was like, oh, it's the Warrior. I don't really want to see the Warrior. I was kind of like amped for Savage to sort of take Hogan's mantle, and we all know how that sort of panned out. So
yeah, man, you really were jaded.
Jaded wasn't the right word. I wasn't excited.
Okay.
Like my favorite was all. I always preferred Savage over the Warrior.
Yeah, no, I did too. But I mean,
I preferred Hogan over the Warrior too. I mean,
yeah, I liked the Warrior as a kid. I mean, he was a guy who I think is interesting. Actually, I think he's a guy who, like Goldberg, had more good things than people remember. Like, I'm not saying that Warrior was actually like a good professional wrestler. I'm not even necessarily saying that Goldberg was, but I think that they had plenty of opportunities where they stepped up and had good performances in key matches. And I think that is something that separates, you know, you from, you know, your average big muscular guy who, you know,
Mason Ryans.
Yeah. Or your Warlord or, you know, whatever, those kind of guys. Yeah. So,
yeah. Warrior obviously had the much ballyhooed WrestleMania 7 match, but I remember from WrestleMania 6, I didn't watch it live. The first pay-per-view I ever watched live was WrestleMania 7. I think we went on that the first time I was on the show. But, I mean, WrestleMania 6, I don't remember that being an excessively terrible match, and neither Hogan nor Warrior really would strike anyone as, like, a great, like, in-ring technician. But I think you were talking about this with Alex Torres in the last podcast that you released, that sometimes spectacle matches can be good for different reasons than the moves were good.
Yes.
And I think it had it going for it. And it was sort of a rare occurrence. I mean, Warrior never again would really have that sort of aura going for him. And then the Savage match was a totally different circumstance. And he probably had some good matches with Rick Rude that I'm not remembering, but only because Rick Rude's kind of, you know, kind of the man.
Sure, sure. Back to Goldberg.
Yeah.
and Goldberg had a lot more athleticism than. I mean, I think Goldberg was a different level than Warrior, but you can kind of compare the two given their longevity. Given,
well,
you
Goldberg
know,
played football. So
that's true. That's true. He did play football. Oh, he was, I mean, incredible, incredible athletic specimen, and he shows it off here during the match. But the thing that I think is interesting about Goldberg in WCW, and there are many things, is that this is his first WCW pay-per-view that he main evented. He won the title in July, and this is August, or I'm sorry, October. And this wasn't, again, not the biggest match on the show. He main evented 6 out of 33 possible pay-per-views in WCW after winning the title.
Yeah, and people talk about, you know, WWE kind of like jerking around their up and comers, but
right. Even you talk is talked about often how WWE used Goldberg, but they had him in 6 of 12 possible main events. Plus he had a run in at, you know, plus the No Way Out main event, which was a SmackDown show, the Eddie Guerrero Brock Lesnar, part of the build for that was Bill Goldberg is a front row ticket to the show. What's he going to do in the main event? So, yeah. The point is that they had this big commodity in Goldberg. He won the title, but was not really treated as a main eventer through a lot of his WCW run. Some of that maybe were, again, some of his limitations, or he was injured for a while. So that's, you know, some of it's explainable, but a lot of it is just kind of like nuts that the fact that he really was not, you know, used as the, you know, he was not the center of the promotion really that often during his time there. And it's just sort of an interesting thing, given the incredible commodity that he was for, you know, a year or more.
Yeah, he was a homegrown guy, too.
Right.
Really, he was the only homegrown WCW guy. Like WCW, I think people make the mistake of saying WCW, like, it did have the lineage of the NWA, but that was a totally different animal, the NWA. That was a whole bunch of different territories that sort of banded together under one governing body.
Sure.
And they just sort of, you know, agglomerate it, and then WCW was a real live promotion. And a lot of the guys, even like Sting and Luger, like, they were inherited by WCW. Everybody else that sort of main evented a WCW pay-per-view at this point, this might be the first time that not just one WCW homegrown guy, but two. I mean, Diamond Dallas Page was around, but you could say he was a WCW creation as well.
Yeah, well, he was an AWA, but...
Yeah, but who remembered? I mean...
Well, I mean, I get what you're saying, though.
You kind of made the point on Twitter. We were talking about Kurt Hennig the other day, last week, and people were saying that he wasn't... That people were so quick to point out that he never won a world title. It kind of speaks to how forgettable the late period AWA was, and it's kind of a shame. I mean, there's a lot of guys who wrestled there, like Jerry Lawler and Nick Bockwinkel, and some other guys. I think my friend Dylan will talk them up a whole lot too, because he's a big AWA. He's a big like wrestling guy, big classic wrestling guy.
Yeah, I need to get him on the show.
Yeah, I'll get him in contact with you.
All right,
but no, it's a shame that like the AWA doesn't get its due. So much in the same way that people like will think of Kurt Hennig and Scott Hall as WWF guys, because that's where they rose to national prominence. Someone like Diamond Dallas Page, who may have done a few things in the AWA, he was really a WCW guy. Just in the same way that like Scott Hall and Kurt Hennig were WWF guys, even though they had big runs in the AWA.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, really the only guys who... you know, start in WCW without any significant prior experience in any major promotion, you know, be it, you know, international or ECW or WWE or whatever, would have been Goldberg and the Giant.
Yeah.
Those really would have been the two, you know, so.
Yeah, pretty much. And they kind of, like, the Giant was smoking cigarettes within, like, 6 months.
Well, it was a little more than that. But at this point, yes, the Giant was – he was almost on his way out. So and he had gotten pretty fat. But although he had a nice – he has a fun – he's involved in a really fun Steiners match at this – which is a show – which is definitely a match you should watch. That's a – that's, like, one of the, like, total most ridiculous, silly, but – totally fun matches ever. Like it totally shouldn't work, but for whatever reason it totally is awesome and it's great. So everyone should watch that match, and they should watch this match too, and we should talk about this match now.
Obviously we should.
Yes. So I like that Mike Tenay and Tony Schiavone, anxious I'm sure to forget about the prior Hulk Hogan Ultimate Warrior match, say, "The hottest question in wrestling. Everyone's been asking about it all week. Can DDP do it?" As if, like, this has been the focus of everything. Like, anything else that's been involved in the show, we've forgotten about, because this is the big thing. So,
And I've got to give them credit here. For as bad as Schiavone was at this point, and this is, like, the height of... Not the height, but it's, like, not the height of the NWO, but the height of Tony Schiavone's obnoxiousness, re the NWO. Like, he and Tenay, and Heenan's there, too. They all do a great job in sort of describing the action in the ring and making out the streak to be a big deal. Like, there are several spots in the match where DDP gets a near fall and they're gasping because the streak might be dead here.
Yeah, and they're setting up DDP nicely as the underdog too, when he's, you know, when he's getting overpowered, when he's getting knocked out of the ring, all that stuff. Like, oh, you know, I don't know if he can do it kind of stuff.
DDP's a ragdoll in this match, and it really makes everything that happens in this match like that much more effective. He takes it such a butt kick, and kind of reminiscent of Shawn Michaels. I mean, he goes a little bit overboard at times, but I think with Goldberg it's warranted, because, you know, Goldberg is like the man child. He's the wrecking ball. He's, you know, he's the guy who gets Megadeth to play Crush Him lied.
Well, I don't know if I'd put that necessarily on his resume, but okay, you know, we'll go with that. So we start with Paige comes out. He runs through the crowd. Definitely, like, he just has like a little bit of extra bounce in his step. Like, you know, this is his big match. This is his first. I'm not sure if this is his first WCW title shot, but it's his first major pay-per-view one. You know, main event. You know, it's definitely the biggest match of his career. And then, you know, you just have really loud Goldberg chants that overwhelm the announcers. You know, both these guys just having big epic entrances. The crowd really goes insane because they do the normal thing where Goldberg comes out of the locker room, followed by a secure.
It was way more. Way longer, way more overwrought than I remember it being.
Yeah.
Which I think it made for a better spectacle.
It was good in this case, yes. I wouldn't want to say that every time, but yeah, it was bigger and longer. Both entrances were pretty extended. And when Goldberg finally stepped out of the locker room and appeared in front of the giant pumpkin, the WCW Halloween Havoc logo, and the fire goes off, I mean, just the crowd went insane when he came out. It was really, really cool. It was just, you know, really a special reaction.
Yeah, they loved Goldberg, and I don't blame them. I mean, Goldberg was this monster of a man, and sometimes the maxim is the Vince McMahon sort of mindset that, you know, bigger is better works. Sometimes it didn't. In this case, I mean, you got a modicum of charisma, and Goldberg, for every one of his faults, Goldberg was had a magnetism about him. You know,
absolutely. Yeah,
he was just a guy that, like, you watch him and you, like, you couldn't help but root for him.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you just an animal, and kind of like the guy you could get behind because you kind of needed an animal to take down the New World Order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that definitely, you know, was why people were trying to do him. I mean, he was just this, you know, monstrous, no nonsense man who just basically plowed through everyone. And then got so much momentum behind him that WCW basically had no chance but to push him up to the top. Although, as we said, he kind of reached his, you know, limits because they really, you know, didn't focus on him as much as you would, you know, as much as they probably should have for the sake of their business and, you know, and for the sake of how popular he was. But, you know, WCW isn't around because of reasons like that. So,
yeah, WCW isn't around because I think they were too corporate and there wasn't enough institutional focus. Whereas WWE, they've become corporate, but they're still institutional focus. That's Vince McMahon's baby.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot of reasons, but that was certainly one of the major ones. But yes, the corporate aspect is very important as well.
It manifests itself with Goldberg. 6 out of 33 pay-per-views that he main evented. That number should be in the 20s. Why? Because Goldberg is he's your answer to Steve Austin.
Right, right, yeah. And they, you know, should have protected him. Instead, they basically, you know, they weakened him and made him where he wasn't special anymore, you know.
Yeah. They feed everybody to him until you're ready to have him lose the streak, and he'll lose the streak to Diamond Dallas Page at some point.
Sure, or whoever, you know, whatever, whoever the right guy is, yeah.
Jericho, Guerrero.
Sure.
Booker T.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of people who it could have been, but
AJ Styles.
Well, you know, it's like it crazy, you know. Yeah. Paige starts by jawing with him. They get each other's face, definitely an animated scene. They sort of push away Mickey J right away, the referee. And just a really fast start with Paige trying to go after Goldberg, and then Goldberg repeatedly pushing him into the corner, and then Paige getting back up and getting pushed in the corner. Eventually, he gets he sort of slows down for a little bit. Paige does, takes his time. Then he's able to get an arm drag. Then they tackle each other, and they both roll each other outside, and then, you know, kind of fight pretty fiercely on the floor. Crowd's really getting
on the outside in this match. For two guys who didn't hate each other, they sort of wrestled the early part of the match like they hated each other.
Well, yeah, it was a good intensity, but it was more just like a "this title is important" intensity. This match is really important intensity. It wasn't. There was definitely like frustration, but I never thought it like went to a level that was unwarranted based on what they were fighting for.
That does make sense. It's reason why I didn't really have a problem with it. But I just thought, you know, Paige seems like he's a cerebral kind of guy. You know, like he didn't get there to the top because, you know, he had the best look or because he could, like, beat somebody up. He was crafty and cagey. And I thought him spending so much time outside of the ring risking a count out was a little bit of a error on his part. But at the same time, maybe you can make the argument that he was also overcome with emotion because this was his first real shot at the big gold belt.
Yeah. Yeah, I see a lot of Jake Roberts in DDP here, who I know Roberts was sort of one of his mentors to, you know, to a certain extent, or a guy he's at least credited for, you know, teaching him a lot about wrestling and a lot about wrestling psychology, and fewer better at it than Jake Roberts was. So I definitely see a lot of in his movements and how, you know, he kind of, even a little bit of just not really slithering around, but kind of sliding around, just that kind of thing. I really think that I definitely see that in this match.
Yeah, and just to take it off the rails just a little bit, imagine if Jake Roberts, you know, had his life together. Like, he could have been, like, the best trainer. Because, like, even right now, like, his influence, like, him being just, like, cracked out of his mind for most of the 80s and 90s, like, there's still so many people who accredit him as being an influence. You know, you mentioned DDP, there's Kazarni, and there's a few other guys.
Yeah.
And, man, you know what? Wrestling would have been a lot better place if more people were learning from Jake Roberts how to be wrestlers.
Yeah, I'm definitely more of a Jake Roberts minimalist, you know, do less with more kind of guy in how I like my wrestling, as opposed to a, you know, needing to shove a move, ears, you know, a high spot in every second of a match, kind of thing. So, yeah, it would have been really, you know, it's one of those, you know, what if kind of things, obviously, because he didn't have his life together. And, you know, he obviously was a big wrestling star, but could have been an even bigger one, and could have, you know, and even, you know, even if he had his got, I mean, you know, it's not too late if he gets his life together at some point. And, you know, I mean, I know there are a lot of people who work in WWE who really respect his mind for wrestling. And, you know, you never know, but it does seem pretty unlikely based on his track record.
Yeah, he seems to have cleaned up now, but he's just, you know, he's just not there anymore.
Oh, I see.
He's just content to sail on his boat.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't heard much about I haven't heard anything about him in the last few years, so I wasn't aware of that. But
yeah, I don't think you are going to hear anything about him because he's one of those guys who's never going to die.
Right. Well, you know,
him and Keith Richards and Ozzy Osbourne and Charles Barkley will be here till the end of the world.
Well, good for them. So they tackle each other, roll outside, Mickey J gets them back in. So they kind of slow down. It's like, okay, we've had this moment, you know, this fiery moment. Now we're just going to slow down. We're going to kind of size each other up, sort of thing. There's massive Goldberg chance at this point. Goldberg gets a wrist lock and DDP sweeps the leg. Then Goldberg does like a really cool like flip up on it, and then DDP sweeps it again. Just really amazing athleticism for his size there as Goldberg. And, you know, Goldberg didn't have like a huge NFL career, but the fact, I mean, he played, I think, for a couple of years, was on like some practice squads and stuff. I mean, it just kind of shows you the incredible athleticism that someone has to have to be even able to be like a marginal NFL or, you know, NBA player too, obviously. I mean, just wow. Just, you know, just yeah. Those little things that are just pretty, you know, incredible to see.
And that whole that sequence there with the leg sweeps and stuff, it kind of shows to me that Goldberg really did take his training and he took the craft of wrestling seriously. I think that might have been one of the biggest knocks on him. People thought that he didn't really take it seriously. And just this match is the biggest like piece of evidence for me to the contrary of that. That, you know, he cared about like trading holds and doing that sort of thing. And doing that whole trading thing where they were telling the story in the beginning of the match.
Yeah. Well, you know, it also may have depended with him with opponent, too. You know, there may have been opponents that, you know, they didn't respect as much or that were not high enough on the card for him to do that with. But with someone like Paige, who he, you know, I think he had personal respect for, and obviously was a guy who WCW was behind, he probably was willing to do that more.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, I don't begrudge him the squash. That was what was part of his mystique.
Sure.
Like him coming out and taking guys like, I don't know, Ernest the Cat Miller or whoever.
Hugh Morris.
And just like, yeah, or, and like crumpling them up like the Car Crusher.
Sure.
Like that was part of his mystique. But it like people might have mistaken that. And I don't know if I'm making up a straw man argument here or not. It just seemed like to me that's what the perception was.
Yeah. Well, I know that there – I mean Jericho had some bad experiences working – or not working with him, wanting to work with him, wanting basically to get squashed by him, and Paige not really being willing – or sorry, Goldberg not really willing – being willing to do that. But, you know, Goldberg was a rookie in wrestling and, you know – didn't understand completely the ins and outs of it, and I think he's even been willing to admit that. So a lot happened to him very quickly. Some of it may have gotten to his head. Some of it may have just been not having the best instincts for it because he hadn't been around it for long. Some of it may being been led astray by the wrong people. You know, all these things. But, you know,
it may have just been being yelled at by the Colonel Buddy Parker at the power plant for 8 hours a day.
Well, there's a lot of things going on there, I think, that kind of led to maybe Goldberg getting the reputation that he had. Some of it may be deserved, some of it maybe not. But as far as I will say for the in-ring work that Goldberg did, like the moves that he did and the execution that he did were almost always flawless. The issue with Goldberg and the limitations were there were more the selling, although he did very well with the selling in this match. But, you know, in longer matches and he didn't always, you know, have the knowledge or whatever to always perform that well. But as far as when it came to actually making things look good and making things look, you know, hard and having innovative moves, he was awesome at that.
Like I thought he sold okay in this match.
He did. In this match, he did. In other matches, I think he was weaker in it. But in this match, okay, he did very well.
Yeah, and he said he busted out some cool moves. I think at one point, we haven't gotten up to it yet, but he busted out a cross arm breaker, which it's a move that has become very chic in wrestling now, but I mean, back then, that was sort of like, that was MMA stuff.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And Goldberg's gimmick was that he was a shoot fighter, which is, you know, I mean, MMA kind of had its first wave of popularity. It kind of ended by this point, but it was kind of like, I don't know, 94, 97-ish, where it was this kind of underground niche thing that, you know, was on pay-per-view and people were into it. And there was a certain, it didn't have nearly the popularity today, but it had a level of popularity where it influenced pro wrestling for a few years. And I think Goldberg was kind of a part of that, or, you know, a consequence of that or whatever. But
yeah,
but that gimmick was his idea, is my understanding. So, I mean, he kind of had a pretty good instinct, obviously, for developing that character that became so popular, which was, you know, basically himself. But, you know, the little touches, I think, were really good, and obviously he understood wrestling on that level to be able to create a character like that on the first go, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, basically that was that's the next sequence. They get each other's face again, then Goldberg gets the cross-arm breaker, DDP gets the ropes, and then Paige is able to sucker him into a jawbreaker, and then he tries the diamond cutter, but basically Goldberg completely shoves him out of the ring, and then we get a few moments of Paige kind of like, wow, he just totally knocked me out of that. I need to regroup. He kind of walks around a little bit and then slowly gets back into the ring.
Yeah. The diamond cutter was a move that I didn't really appreciate until after DDP was gone.
Okay.
Randy Orton does a good version of it, but DDP's was the best.
Yes. I always liked Paige. I think Paige, the one thing that he did was like, he had a more variety of positions in which he was able to do it. I think.
Yeah, Randy Orton just does it either from out of nowhere, or he does it countering a high flying move. And don't get me wrong, I mean, from the first time I've ever seen him do it, countering out of the shooting star press, which was one of the biggest, most impressive spots I've ever seen in my entire life. DDP always had more versatility. Like, he would do it TKO style. He'd do it off the ropes. Off the turnbuckles, just a very, very innovative,
yeah,
kind of guy.
It was good. It was fluid. I mean, the diamond cutter was an excellent finisher, no question about it. And it was over. I mean, it was really like you hit it and it was done. I mean, obviously the RKO is way over too. One of the reasons why it's so effective, but
basically, and you know what? It, it, when this is why whenever CM Punk says that Johnny Ace wasn't a good wrestler, I mean, the most over move in wrestling history used by at least three guys who were like iconic wrestlers with multiple world championships, and then also used by Disco Inferno and Vince McMahon, just out of whatever variation it was. I mean, it was because of Johnny Ace. So,
well, there you go.
So yeah, it's called the Ace Crusher for a reason. So
go, Johnny, go.
Next time you're fawning over John Laurinaitis for his amazing deadpan delivery, also appreciate him because he gave you the Ace Crusher, a.k.a. the Diamond Cutter, a.k.a. the Stone Cold Stunner.
Yeah. So we're back in the ring, and Goldberg works an armbar for a bit. DDP then rolls through, gets a cool leg takedown, and then gets the side headlock, but then Goldberg basically pushes out of it and then shoulder blocks him out of the ring again. And I like the announcers talking about the strategy there. It's like, okay, well, when Paige gets him down, it works. But then when he gets the headlock, then there's no way that Paige can match Goldberg's power there. So, then we get, once DDP gets back in, he drops, his neck on the ropes, follows with a neck breaker, and then he tosses him into the corner and then nails a Russian leg sleep and gets a pretty good near fall on that. It was a nice little flurry of moves with Paige kind of catching Goldberg by surprise. Then follows it immediately with a front face lock, sort of a slow things down, and we get some more massive Goldberg chance again.
Yeah, it's amazing how something so fake sounding at first grew into something organic.
Mm-hmm.
So
the Goldberg chants.
Yes, the Goldberg chants. They were so piped in at first.
It's interesting because you get the Goldberg chants, and Goldberg is clearly the man they're more behind, but Paige doesn't get booed here at all. People are really into Paige here, and into the later near fall, when it looks like he might win the match. They're really into that.
It's amazing how many different matches that they'd have, that there would be sort of like that dynamic where both guys were liked by the crowd.
Exactly.
I mean, we'd see this at Starrcade later on, because Nash wasn't exactly a bad guy at that point. He was sort of the cool heel, and cool heels got cheered.
Right, right. That's true. They also had that. Although I think even more so, Paige was over with this crowd more than Nash was over with the other crowd. But certainly, it was a similar dynamic both times, no question about it. Then Goldberg's able to get up. They trade knees to the gut, and then Goldberg gets he had a cool variation of the swinging neckbreaker that I always liked. He just got like a really good snap on it. That was, always looked really cool. Then Goldberg dodges DDP's punches. He hits what I would have to call a power arm drag, where it's sort of like a power slam, but he gets him over by the arm, follows it with a side slam, and then sort of does an interesting thing where he just presses down with his hands and for the near fall. Kind of like I wasn't really intended to be like him playing the heel, but it's sort of an arrogant thing to do. It was kind of interesting.
Yeah, he's it kind of fit into his character. Like, he was always just so pumped up that he feared he could just like press down his opponent's chest. Like, it reminded a little bit of the Jericho, come on, pin.
Right.
The facials and how lapse it was, but at the same time, it was for different reasons. Like, Jericho was just doing it to be a dick.
Sure. Oh, and also
a very good dick. But
right. And Jericho was also, like, sort of half standing on the guy's. I mean, he wasn't trying to do a serious cover.
It wasn't the same motion. It was just, they were similar. They seemed very similar in spirit to me.
Sure, sure. So we get another cross arm bar by Goldberg, but then Paige gets to the ropes. Tony sort of relays a story at this point about Goldberg wrestling other guys in the Falcons locker room back when he was in the NFL. And then Bill Frelick, who was a famous player, saying that he wanted no part of Goldberg because Goldberg is nuts. So,
which actually, and you know what, it's a sort of shades of the old Tony who was able to, I mean, we saw this before. It was all went downhill when the NWO started, because that's when Bischoff would get in his ear and just keep telling him to, hey, you know, talk about the NWO all the time, even if it was Guerrero versus Jericho in an opening match, which the crowd should have been at, which the crowd was normally into.
Right.
I mean, I was watching the Eddie Guerrero DVD, and there was a match between Eddie Guerrero and I think it was Shinjiro Otani. I don't quote me on that. It was either Otani or Liger. And the commentation from Schiavone was spot on. And then later on, it was Guerrero versus Malenko. And it was just basically him prattling on about the NWO for the whole time.
Yeah.
Then you get to this match, and Tony and Mike Tenay, and I'm not the biggest Mike Tenay fan right now. I think he's overmatched in his role as play-by-play now. I won't call him bad. I'll call him overmatched, and he gets no help from Taz whatsoever. But as the sort of like the technical guy, the technical color guy who would come on during the junior matches, the cruiser matches, and just give stats, that's when he was the best.
Yes, I think I've said it before, but I think Mike Tenay was made for giving stats before matches. That's Mike Tenay's specialty. That's what he was good at, and giving, you know, giving colorful facts about wrestlers. Those seem to be his strengths, definitely as a commentator.
Yes.
I like Mike Tenay sort of as a guy, but I do agree that I think overmatched is a good word to use for him as a commentator. I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
So we follow up with Paige getting a head scissors, but to sort of end this Goldberg flurry. But then Goldberg ends up getting up first and just plowing him with a super kick right to the chest, and just Paige is falling back, really bumping well for that. But then we get even better. Goldberg charges into the corner as fast as he can, and then Paige moves, and then Goldberg just tumbles out of the ring really hard, and Paige sort of slumps and falls out of the apron. And it's really cool. The camera, they don't cut to different angles on the camera. They just have the handheld camera right down there, and they kind of veer both back and forth on them as they both kind of struggle to get up and compose themselves after that big, big spot.
Yeah, this is a spot that Goldberg did all the time, the shoulder into the ring post.
Yeah, but this was the best one I've ever seen him do.
Yeah, I noted it when I was watching it, that this was just very, very, like, well done. Like, I'm surprised he didn't dislocate his shoulder there.
Yeah.
But, like, he would do it all the time, and every time he would, like, do it full force. And that's just, you know, I mean, again, you don't want to talk about someone who's not in it full time. He wouldn't do that if he wasn't in this full time, you know?
Right.
If he didn't consider himself a wrestler, he wouldn't be putting his body on the line like that.
Sure, sure.
Big bumps to me are always more impressive than big offensive maneuvers. I mean, I love offense. I mean, I love all aspects of wrestling. I wouldn't be a writer about wrestling if I didn't. But whereas I always love the big high spots on the offensive end, something that will always make me drop my jaw even more than like a big move is if a guy goes over the top rope to the outside on his own volition, and it isn't because someone forgot to catch him, like one Mike Mizanin forgot to do. Alberto Del Rio takes a spot like that every match.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised that it took him this long to get hurt.
Right.
Because of that.
Yeah.
Like Alberto Del Rio is going to kill himself in the ring someday, but it still looks impressive. I mean, it's kind of hypocritical, or maybe like a very cold or callous thing for me to say, but it's impressive looking.
Yeah, Daniel Bryan's dive outside the ring always, you know, like, wow, like he's, you know, going to kill himself at one point, because a lot of times he won't. I mean, the guy will move and then he'll run into the, you know, he'll hit the floor or hit the, you know, the apron or something, and or I'm sorry, the barrier. So
yeah, he wipes it. Punk does this too, although Bryan does it with more frequency. And I think it's because of their attitude of being the indie guys. And the indie guys take insane bumps like that all the time.
Anyway, so we have Goldberg struggling to get up, favoring his shoulder. He gets into the ring. Then Paige bounces off, jumps to the top rope, and then hits a clothesline, which gets two. Then he comes off the ropes, and Goldberg tries to lift him up with a spine buster, but then Paige gets a DDT instead. he signals for the diamond cutter, but then Goldberg's able to muster up the energy to land the spear, but immediately grabs his shoulder after it. The double count reaches 7. Then Goldberg.
Yeah, this is the sort of the long term selling, sort of like the not the long term, but like sort of like the limb selling that really really impressed me most about Goldberg in this match. The presence of mind that even when he was on offense, when he was like being the wrecking ball, he wasn't hitting his moves at full force because of that shoulder.
Right, right. Then he tries to lift him up with one arm for the jackhammer, but then he can't get him up. The first time. He lifts him up the second time, and then Paige rolls out of it, and then goes down the back, and then he turns around, hits the diamond cutter, which is this enormous pop for hitting the diamond cutter.
And yeah, the place just explodes for that. And,
right.
And then Goldberg kind of just rolls out of the ring or away from Paige, and it's basically. The crowd's spent here, I think.
Right. Well, like, you know, Tony's like, they're standing in Las Vegas and everyone's up, and then the double count reaches 8, and finally Paige crawls over for the cover, and it's only 2. And then there's like a sigh when that happens, like, oh, wow, you know, he couldn't quite get him. And then immediately Paige tries the suplex, but then Goldberg reverses it, lifts him up immediately, and then gets the jackhammer, and then that's 3, and that's it. And it's 155-0 is the streak at this point. So, and then I love Tony's
all legit too.
Well, yeah. And I love Tony's call here. That was a remarkable match, and all I can think of is, God, I love this sport. That's a pretty awesome call by Tony Schiavone right there. I have to give him a lot of props for that one.
I think this is like, you know, how, like a guy in regular sport gets hurt. It's like a real devastating injury, and then he comes back, and he's just not the same until like, he has one or two games that are like sort of mirages. This was that sort of mirage game for Tony Schiavone. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether it was because Bischoff had not cared at this point because the NWO portion of the show was over, but hey, thank God that whatever happened because he was on point this match. I want to say he was probably the most impressive participant, and I don't know whether it was because my expectations were just so low going in for his call of the match.
Yeah,
but him especially that made the match very enjoyable for me.
Right, and I thought Tanay and Heenan did a nice job too, and they both kind of compliment the match. I mean, Tanay kind of echoes what Tony says, then Heenan like brings up, you know, I don't normally do this, but you know, Paige showed a lot of guts out there, and you know, and so on and so forth. And they have a nice.
That separates Heenan. Well, actually, it separates the old school heel announcers from the new guys who try to play the heel. I guess today it's only Michael Cole because Taz, if he's the heel, he's half-assed at it, and Jerry Lawler is not going to heel on anybody anymore. He's just too damn like lazy, old, whatever. But like the Heenans and the Venturas of the world would, you know, give the good guys their props once in a while. I mean, Ventura hated Hulk Hogan, but he wasn't like at WrestleMania 6. He was going to note when Hogan made a good decision against
sure.
Warrior.
Sure.
And Heenan would give his props to guys like Diamond Dallas Page every once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. And Heenan wasn't even really a full heel at this point anyway. Kind of the NWO kind of, you know, he sort of was in that in-between character depending on the circumstances. And he was – the one thing with Heenan was consistent about is they love Goldberg throughout the entire thing. Like, I don't know who made that choice, but I thought that was always a good choice where Heenan was like the biggest – Goldberg supporter. It kind of added to like when they were building up, it kind of added to the majesty of Goldberg in a sense where it was like, you know, Heenan would say stuff like, you know, I'm retired from managing, but the only guy I would come out of retirement for would be Goldberg. Like he put over Goldberg as something super duper special. That was really cool that he always did that.
And that's a lost art. Like it seems WWE has the idea, but they're doing it all wrong. Like, they think that by putting Michael Cole's attack dogs on people, that gets some sympathy with the crowd. And really, all it really does is just, if the guy's not already over, like, it's sort of like, yeah, you get like a little sympathy pop, but it just doesn't work.
Yeah, I think it's sort of more of an overdoing than anything. I think it's just sort of like it's incessant with Cole. It's just a dynamic that doesn't work. But
but if you think about it, like Vince McMahon, Gorilla as well, and Piper and Savage when they were in the booth, but Vince McMahon did so much more. It might be different because it was his company. But he did so much to get the guys like Hogan and Savage and Bret Hart and Shawn, especially Shawn Michaels. Vince McMahon, I thought he was just going to pop out of the booth at SummerSlam 96 when Michaels beat Vader for the fifth time during their main event match and just like, you know, just kind of give him the old slobber knob treatment in the middle of the ring.
Right. Sorry, I didn't say your joke there properly. I apologize. I thought you had more to say, so I apologize for my lack of selling. I feel like Davey Richards right now, you know?
This is take care, spike your hair all over again.
Right, yes. Well, that one I just didn't get, you know, because I was not aware of Zack Ryder's YouTube television show. But, well, I was aware of it. I just didn't watch it.
Poor Zack Ryder.
Yeah, poor Zack Ryder. Now, you know, Jason's not watching his show and not getting his jokes, and he's being crippled, and his girlfriend's kissing another dude, and, you know.
Apparently hustle, loyalty, respect means cock blocking.
Apparently it does. Well, you know. Anyway, at the end of this, Goldberg, you know, lifts up DDP, raises his hand, they have their moment together, then Paige kind of hobbles out of the ring and goes to the apron, and then Goldberg's alone celebrating in the ring. And kind of, I would say this is the best moment, the best match of Goldberg's title reign. From winning from after he won the title to the end of it, I would say this is probably his best moment and his best match.
I wouldn't disagree with that, but I am way behind on this Goldberg project. I want to watch some of his other matches. Actually, someone YouTubed me a match after he went to WWE and against Mark Henry, which I'm really looking forward to watching. But there was a match with Sting in there that I heard was really good.
That's a good one, yeah. That's a Nitro match, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I'll take your word for it, but just given having watched this match and just being blown away by how really good everything was, from the announcing to both competitors in the ring to the crowd, which was hot for the whole thing until the Diamond Cutter. They were still kind of hot after that, but it peaked. You could tell it peaked with the Diamond Cutter.
Yeah, I thought that they were into the finish, though. I mean, I thought the finish came off well, and then the crowd was pretty much into it. I don't remember there being particularly a lull, you know.
It did, but that Diamond Cutter was just...
That was clearly... That got an insane reaction, no question about it. Absolutely. So... Well, TH, you got anything else to share with us?
I am pretty busy around the internet, even though I'm also busy in real life with a job and a kid and a dog and a wife and a house. But the wrestling blog is where you'll find me most of the time. It's wallsofjerichoholic.blogspot.com. I update a whole lot, reviews, commentary, news with Spin. It's not a dirt sheet. It's not a news site. It's just basically my thoughts on wrestling and a bunch of pictures and YouTubes. I also contribute to Fair to Flair. I try to do that once a week or once every other week if I get too busy. I also write an independent wrestling-based column for Cage Side Seats. And I've been writing for the Camel Clutch blog for almost 2 years now. Same deal, once every week or every 2 weeks. So I'm almost everywhere on the internet. And I also have a food blog, which on Tumblr, which I sort of update a couple times a week. So it's called th-eats-blog.tumblr.com, and it's called Holzerman Hungers.
Which is a good name.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there'll be a lot of breakfast sandwiches. and you can find me on Twitter at T Holzerman.
Yes. And of course you have both your wrestling podcast and your non-wrestling podcast.
Yes. The Brett Wrestling Podcast is weekly. depending on when this gets posted, the most recent podcast will either be Case Sawyer Paul, or it'll be Joe Drilling, or if that falls through again, it'll be someone else, but it'll be someone good. And the non-wrestling one is monthly. The last one I had Sarah Sprague on. It's kind of out of date because we talk a lot about the Super Bowl, but really food is not ever untimely, and we talk a lot about guacamole and other things.
Cool. Well, you are definitely a busy man, but the work that you do is always excellent, and appreciate you being part of the Fair to Flair family and being a guest for the fourth time on my show. And I've done two of yours, and I don't know how many Flair to Flair episodes that we've done together, but we're almost getting up to like 10. You know, I don't know if we need to start like, you know, marking these occasions with like, you know, gifts or some sort of celebration, but, you know.
I say we mark it with craft beer and celebratory paintings commissioned by our multiple amounts of profits from the quarterly.
All right, that sounds like a wonderful idea. I'll put you in charge of that.
Right, and I thanks for the kind words. They're always very appreciated.
Well, you're very welcome.
Especially from someone as yourself who is a connoisseur of all fine things wrestling.
Well, I try my best. So, and everyone, thanks for checking us out.
Let's be honest. Most wrestling websites suck. BS rumors, schoolyard gossip, plagiarism. It's no wonder why no one believes anything they read on the internet. Well, if you can't get something done right, you might as well do it yourself. Presenting the Fair to Flair Quarterly from the writers of FairToFlair.com and over a dozen other wrestling websites. We're not copy and pasting what we read in some newsletter. This is 100% original content from the best wrestling bloggers on the internet. In-depth analysis of the art of pro wrestling, debate, artwork, and humor. The Fair to Flair Quarterly will raise the bar of what wrestling journalism can and should be. Professionally edited and produced, and every contributor will be paid for their work. Order your copy of the Fair to Flair Quarterly today at FairToFlair.com. The better wrestling media has arrived.